Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
$1 billion con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and at 1400 GMT on Monday the 20th of May, these are our main stories. Iran has confirmed the deaths of President Ibrahim Raisi and the country's foreign minister in a helicopter crash. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court is seeking an arrest warrant for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The UN's human rights chief says he's deeply alarmed by the destruction of one of the main towns in Myanmar's Rakhine state. Also in this podcast, why Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is extending his term in office without calling an election. Iranians are coming to terms with the news confirmed early on Monday morning that their president, Ebrahim Raisi, has been killed in a helicopter crash in the remote northwest of the country. Pictures from the scene show burnt wreckage on a forested mountainside. The country's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, and several other officials were also killed. This was how the Iranians heard about the death of their president on national TV.
In the name of God, of Allah, the blessed Prophet Muhammad and the family of Muhammad, in today's first news segment, we belong to God and to Him we shall return. The servant of Reza, the servant of the Iranian people, Ayatollah Ebrahim Raisi, the president of the Republic of Iran, was martyred while serving the people of Iran.
I heard more from G.R. Gol of BBC Persian.
What we know so far is the weather condition was so severe, there was no visibility at all. That's why the question was raised by many supporters of the President Raisi, why he was put on that helicopter and fly away, while in normal circumstances it would never have happened, even for civilian people traveling on helicopter. They announced almost after 3 a.m. in the morning, local time, his helicopter has been found. The rescue team have reached the crashing site and have minutes later they announced they have recovered his body, and also the foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, and also the governor of West Azerbaijan province, is a major province in northwest of Iran, and also the representative of Iran's supreme leader in Tabriz.
Unusual for two such key figures to be traveling together?
It is very unusual, but I think there were other ministers also in his convoy, but they were traveling on different helicopters, many ministers. I think the reason most likely the foreign minister was with him because they were participating in a ceremony to open a dam which jointly with Azerbaijan, the president of Azerbaijan also was present there to open this dam, and is a sign of cooperation. Don't forget, in the past 2 years, the relationship between two countries has been very bumpy road because Iran has accused Azerbaijan of supporting Israel, and this was a sign of mending relationships. So Amir Abdullahian being there in normal circumstances, yes, why you put two prominent figures of the government on the same helicopter? But obviously he was there because the president of a neighboring country was there as well.
Now, what's been the reaction in Iran?
Well, it's a very mixed reaction. If you look at those who are hardliner and supporter of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, yesterday they were praying for his safety and return back to Tehran in one piece. But if you look at most people in Iran, if you look at on social media, many people were making jokes and excited about the concept he was killed. Don't forget, he was a very divisive figure. Many people saw him as a one who was appointed by the Guardian Council, which is appointed again, their members by Supreme Leader. They believed he came to prominence by an engineered election by the Supreme Leader.
He'd been around since the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Tell us how he climbed the power structure.
Well, at the age of 20, the very beginning of the revolution, he became a prosecutor. He had a very important role in putting to death many political prisoners, same his own age. And in the 80s, he was one of the member of a committee appointed by the founder of Iran Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, to deal with political prisoners. Later, this committee, known as a death committee, they executed more than 5,000 political prisoners in the 80s. That's why many called him the butcher of Tehran. So the reality is many families are sad he's gone. The family of the victim, they believe he should have survived and faced justice in an international court.
G.R. Gull. So, what next for Iran? And how resilient is the system that Mr. Raisi's successor will inherit? For a look ahead, I spoke to our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
One of the things that was due to happen by protocol has already happened, announced by the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, which is that the Vice President, Mohammad Mokhtar, is taking over as interim president. This is during a period of up to 50 days preparing for a new election. And the stress has been very strongly from the Iranian authorities, from Ayatollah Khamenei himself down, that Iranian people should be reassured that the smooth running of the country will continue, that there won't be any shift or change in the short term. That's very much the message they're trying to get across.
So if we're talking about the succession, who are the main movers and shakers that we should be keeping an eye on?
I mean, there's nobody who has been groomed in the way that Ebrahim Raisi was. He had two shots at the election, 2017, when he lost to the more pragmatic reformist Hassan Rouhani, and then he won in 2021. And there's no one who's been in that position by the power elite, the hardline power elite. So it's going to be a little bit difficult in terms of giving the profile, finding the person who will have that replacement, because essentially what the people around the Supreme Leader want is to have another hardliner, another person where there won't be much light between the president and the man who's the ultimate decision maker, which is the Supreme Leader. So the man who's the vice president, the man who's president interim now, Mohammad Mokhtar, he is a possibility, but he doesn't have a massive personal profile. It would very much be probably some kind of gerrymandered election to try to get him there. The Speaker of Parliament, Mohammad Kalibaf, he is a powerful figure who's been quite dominant in politics for years, but whether he constitutionally will play that role, because as Speaker he's meant to oversee the elections, will he step aside from that and present himself as a candidate? Then from potentially the more reformist side, you have a former foreign minister, Mohammad Zarif. He, with Hassan Rouhani, was really instrumental in the moves to try and have an agreement over Iran's nuclear program, but one that when President Trump was in power, he essentially withdrew the US, and we've seen things go from bad to worse since then. That was a very slightly different era from what we've seen since. So these are perhaps three of the main players, but it's all up in the air at the moment, I would say, as far as candidates are concerned. And the big question will be, in the previous election, 2021, I mean, no reformist, no one who didn't have the imprimatur of the power elite was allowed to stand. Will that happen again?
Sebastian Usher. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has asked for arrest warrants to be issued against three senior leaders of Hamas for their role in the October the 7th attacks against Israel. The call for arrest warrants against the three named officials, Yahya Sinwar, Mohamed Diab Ibrahim al-Masri and Ismail Haniyeh, came as no surprise. But in a move which has infuriated the Israeli government, the prosecutor, Karim A. Khan, also issued this statement about Israeli actions in Gaza.
My office charges Netanyahu and Gallant as co-perpetrators and as superiors in the commission of these alleged crimes. Israel, like all states, has the right to defend its population. It has every right to ensure the return of hostages that have been criminally and callously taken. Those rights, however, do not absolve Israel of its obligations to comply with international humanitarian law. Intentionally causing death, starvation, injury, and suffering to the civilian population, including so very many women and children, are criminal means to achieve military and political goals. That's what we allege.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Dan Johnson, told us more.
We've got a statement from the Office of the Chief Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, as well as those three senior Hamas leaders. It names Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the Israeli Defence Minister. And he says, my office submits that the war crimes alleged in these applications were committed in the context of an international armed conflict between Israel and Palestine and in a non-international armed conflict between Israel and Hamas. Now, we have just in the last couple of minutes got a quick response from a source close to the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, a source saying this is a decision that, if implemented, would be a disgrace on a global scale. There is no limit to hypocrisy. So I think it's clear there from sources close to Benjamin Netanyahu what the Israeli Prime Minister thinks to this application being made by the International Criminal Court's Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan. Important to note that this is not automatic. It doesn't mean the arrest warrants are issued. It doesn't mean anyone's going to be arrested in the near future. This is an application based on the evidence that the chief prosecutor has collected over the last few weeks and months. It will then have to be considered by judges at the International Criminal Court. They will decide what happens next.
Dan Johnson. To Taiwan now. That was the sound of cannons being fired at a ceremony in Taipei for the inauguration of the new Taiwanese president, William Lai. The celebrations featured traditional outfits, musical performances and dancing dragons. In his speech, Mr. Lai urged Beijing to stop its military rhetoric against his country. He added that it was essential for Taipei to be ready to defend itself.
In the face of the many threats and infiltration attempts from China, we must demonstrate our resolution to defend our nation. And we must also raise our defence awareness and strengthen our legal framework for national security.
Our Taiwan correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, was at the ceremony and told us more about what William Lai said.
It's part a celebration of Taiwan's culture, its democracy, its society, its way of life here. And it was part a fairly robust, I would say a robust but cautious speech by Taiwan's new president, William Lai, Lai Ching-te. He very much followed the line taken by the previous president, Tsai Ing-wen, in when he talked about China. So holding very firm to the idea that Taiwan, under its official name, the Republic of China, is an independent sovereign nation and that it will stand up for itself against China, but also that he's not going to change the status quo. So looking to America, looking to Taiwan's friends and allies and saying, look, I'm not going to do anything to change the status quo here. I'm basically a safe pair of hands. You don't need to worry. We want to maintain basically the situation that has been here for the last 8 years under President Tsai. So this is more of a continuation presidency than something completely new.
As he takes office, Mr. Lai will have to deal with difficulties at home and abroad, most notably a Chinese president who lays claim to the self-governing island. So how is Beijing viewing this inauguration? Here's Stephen McDonnell.
The government in Beijing doesn't like the ruling party in Taipei. I mean, that's putting it mildly. Urged people in Taiwan to vote for not the DPP. It didn't work. The kind of preempting his leadership, if you like, by saying it's going to be terrible. Anyone who urges reunification is going to be persecuted in Taiwan, this type of thing. From the messaging we're getting from the Chinese government, it's just more of the same. Now, of course, another way in which they can apply pressure is, you know, all the military flyovers, the jets, the ships coming close to Taiwan, increasingly close, more and more tensions with, you know, fishermen on either side of the Taiwan Strait. And we might expect that being ramped up even more. And so we're in for a few more years of tension, it would seem.
Stephen McDonnell. In the face of waning popularity and accusations by Russia of lacking political legitimacy, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is extending his term in office without calling an election. Opinion polls suggest the move, which is allowed because martial law was imposed when Russia began its full-scale invasion in 2022, has broad support. But as our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, reports, some critics have silenced their arguments for the sake of stability.
Watching President Zelensky's inauguration day exactly 5 years ago is like viewing a different Ukraine. The younger, fresher-faced comedian-turned-leader enthusiastically greets crowds. No stubble, no stern expression. He had, after all, just won a landslide victory with 73% of the vote.
Yeah, it was a very exciting day.
Oleksandr Danyluk was on his team at the time. He was appointed Secretary of the National Security and Defence Council, but left a few months later because of political differences.
None of us didn't expect what was ahead of us.
Russia's full-scale invasion meant Mr. Zelensky's election promise to negotiate peace with Vladimir Putin had failed. Mr. Danyluk claims he believed Ukraine should have been preparing for an unavoidable war. So does he regret supporting him?
No, I don't. Zelensky was the person who actually had this ability to reach to everyone across the globe.
Ukraine needs weapon supply.
After turning down offers to leave, President Zelensky became the cheerleader-in-chief for his country's cause, and he'd never been more popular.
We have no fear, nor should anyone in the world have it.
Andriy Kurkov, a well-known Ukrainian writer and an avid observer of society, once described President Zelensky as the James Bond of the world.
Now President Zelensky looks like a very tired James Bond, much older and a bit grumpy. Still, majority of Ukrainians support him.
In peacetime, an election would have been called, but the martial law brought in with Russia's full-scale invasion means that can't happen.
There is no alternative. So even if we have elections tomorrow, it will be Zelensky again.
There is, as Anton Hrushetsky from the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology points out, broad public support for elections being put on ice.
So for the Ukrainians, it's a clear priority, number one, to win the war and then to hold an election.
How do you see the end of President Zelensky's term? And do you have any idea of what the public will be looking for next?
There will be a strong desire from the population to have new powers because more and more people will be like blame Zelensky for like preparation to the war, for some other problems, for some corruption, etc. Right now, he's a military leader and actually his brave actions in the beginning, it was very good for Ukraine.
Right now, Volodymyr Zelensky is focusing on the front lines instead of foreign travel. He recently handed out medals to troops who were being forced backwards.
Slava Ukraine.
So how much longer should he go on for? I ask his former ally, Oleksandr Danyluk.
Constitution says that president and the parliament are legitimate. And whoever tried to question it actually plays in interest of Russia. And the president, Zelensky, will lead this war one way or another, whether he likes it or not. That's the case. That's his destiny.
A day of political reckoning for Ukraine's leader is desired and will come. For now, he says calls for an election are irresponsible. And Ukrainians seem to broadly agree.
James Waterhouse. Still to come on this podcast, how to teach a computer to recognise sarcasm.
Oh my God, you almost gave me a heart attack. Oh.
Those recordings are annotated for sarcasm by experts, and we use those annotations as training data for our algorithm.
And how the world's biggest ever discovery of gold turned out to be a hoax.
Press freedom, the reasons why it's under increasing pressure.
How the mass use of drones has changed the way the war is being fought.
The trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
The explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The UN's most senior human rights official says he's deeply alarmed by the reported destruction of one of the main towns in Myanmar's Rakhine state and the expulsion of its Rohingya population. Volker Turk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, warned that there was an acute risk of further atrocities after military units in Rakhine surrendered to the insurgent Arakan army. More details from our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
The Arakan Army is one of the most successful groups fighting against the military regime in Myanmar. In the past 6 months, it's taken control of at least half of Rakhine State and captured thousands of soldiers. But its latest victory in the town of Butidong has raised fears over its treatment of Muslim Rohingyas, who make up most of the town's population. Local residents have said they were told to evacuate Butidong by the Arakan army as it prepared to take control of it. They say the entire downtown area has now been razed to the ground, with tens of thousands of Muslims forced to flee into the fields outside. The Arakan army blames the destruction on bombing raids carried out by the Air Force and says it is now helping those who fled. The United Nations has appealed to all armed groups in Rakhine to protect civilians and give access to humanitarian agencies. The Arakan army is backed by much of the Rakhine Buddhist population, some of whom took part in the attacks 7 years ago that killed thousands of Rohingyas and drove more than 700,000 over the border into Bangladesh. The insurgents, who say they're fighting for self-rule in Rakhine, have in the past promised to respect the rights of the Muslim population. However, the forced conscription of Rohingyas by the military this year to help it fight against the Arakan army has revived mistrust between the two communities, raising concern over what will happen to Rohingyas living in the areas which are now controlled by the insurgents.
Jonathan Head. South Africa has one of the highest rates of unemployment in the world, more than 30% across the whole adult population. That stretches to above 50% for young people. As the country heads to the polls at the end of the month, it's an issue that could determine how people vote, as our correspondent Anne Soy reports.
I've come to Umlazi Township in Durban. It's a busy day at the community hall. Probably hundreds of people here carrying their academic certificates and CVs. They're entering their details, their profile. All that information will go into a centralised government system which employers can access when they have opportunities. What is your name?
My name is Moshi Makwaza. I'm hoping to get job, any job, because I'm desperate.
Shabalala is Mongo. I'm 27 years old.
My name is Amanda Shabalala. I'm 27 years old. Way too many people are sitting at home without jobs, including graduates. It's also not easy to start a business because we do not have the money for it. Many live with their grandparents and rely on grants. Unemployment is too high.
The Ministry of Labour has been running jobs fairs like this one for 4 years. The minister, Tulas Ngesi, tells me out of nearly 4 million people who have registered in their database, just about a quarter of a million have been linked to jobs.
There are historical structural issues which are linked to education and skills development.
ANC has been in power for 30 years. There are South Africans who are born after apartheid who are feeling like this is a betrayal. There are just no jobs for them.
A mess which has been created for over 200 years. And to think that when people refer to us as a young nation, over 30 years, we think that we'll be able to deal with that. We'll just be dreaming. We will have to be systemic.
Planned blackouts, known as load shedding, have limited productivity in manufacturing and mining, driven the cost of doing business up, and even services like health, education and water have been affected. New data show that over 300,000 jobs were lost during the first quarter of this year. I met two women who were retrenched in April.
It's very bad because I'm the breadwinner, so we don't know what we're going to do, so we are struggling.
How do you feel about, you know, the handling of government, of all this situation?
Government has failed us.
Are you going to vote?
I'm going to vote, but not for the ruling party at the moment, because they failed us. They did nothing for us.
And what about you?
I always voted for ANC, but now I change my mind because they're not giving us anything. They've got empty promises, I can say.
The disappointment with the ruling ANC is huge, but the opposition remains untested. South Africans make their choice in just over a week.
Anne Soy. It's the story of the biggest gold discovery in history and the mysterious man behind its multi-billion dollar downfall. In 1995, Canadian mining company BreeX announced to the world it had found a significant amount of gold deep in the jungles of Indonesia. Stock prices soared as investors worldwide fought to stake their claim. But when BreeX's chief geologist mysteriously fell from a helicopter over the jungle, the story of the billion-dollar discovery began to unravel. Nearly three decades later, no one has ever been held accountable. Now, the Canadian journalist Suzanne Wilton revisits the story she just couldn't let go of for a new podcast for the BBC World Service. She takes listeners from the jungles of Indonesia to small-town Alberta in Canada to investigate what really happened and find out more about the man behind the biggest gold mine fraud of all time. Suzanne, so you've spent the last 2 years investigating the story for your podcast, The $6 Billion Gold Scam.
Yes, that's right. It's a story that started in 1993 from humble beginnings in the basement of a Calgary home owned by a CEO of a small Canadian mining company called Briex. Then in 1995, they announced the discovery of substantial gold deposits in the jungles of Indonesia. It was the largest the world had ever seen. Investors jumped at the chance to buy shares and gold fever took hold. Let's hear from Warren Irwin. He was a hedge fund manager at the time.
There was a frenzy and a sense of greed that I have not seen since in the markets. The level of greed back then was just unbelievable. And the newspapers were jumping all over this and pumping it too. So there was money, there was greed, and there was a sense of legitimacy, and the numbers being spouted were just huge.
So what went wrong?
They had sold a $6 billion gold discovery to the world. It was quite something for a small Canadian mining company in the 1990s. But the gold they claimed to have found, well, it didn't exist. After another mining company checked their results and realized it was a hoax, the chief geologist who discovered the gold, Michael de Guzman, jumped from a helicopter into the Borneo jungle. At least that's the official story. Let's hear from Andrew Neal. He was a geologist from Freeport-McMoRan. That's the company that uncovered the scam.
He says, "You're not going to believe this." I said, "What?" He says, "De Guzman just fell out of a helicopter." I said, no, that never happened." He says, "No, that's what we're being told. He fell out of a helicopter." He said, "We really need to know what's going on here." I went to the lab guys. I said, "Guys, we've got to work on this sample right now." I says, "But strict protocols." I said, "Take off any jewelry, nobody wearing any gold chains, nobody can put anything into it." Now they're sensing the criticality of what's going on.
And at this point, were investors scrambling to get their money back?
Actually, no. And this is why it's a story about greed, gold fever, and the lengths people will go to in the pursuit of getting rich. Here's Warren Irwin again.
A friend of mine's wife said, "Oh, no, Warren, you're wrong. It's going way higher." And then I had another buddy of mine. I said, "Remember that 911 turbo you always wanted to buy? Well, you just made enough money on this to buy that dream 911 turbo you wanted to buy. Please buy it." He goes, no, Warren, it's going way higher." Nobody would believe anything I had to say.
Was anyone ever brought to justice? What became of the chief geologist?
No one has ever been brought to justice. But I've been investigating what really happened to the man behind it all, Michael de Guzman. Was the body found on the jungle floor really his, or was his fall an elaborate exit strategy? We've come across new evidence, which brings us closer to the truth.
And to hear more on that story from the BBC World Service and CBC, search for the $6 billion gold scam wherever you get your podcasts. Now, here's a story I'm sure you're all really interested in. It's about how to spot sarcasm, which is not easy for computers, voice recognition software and artificial intelligence. And it matters because more and more of what we do is being mediated through conversations with computers. As a result, AI is now being trained to spot sarcasm using a database of annotated speech. The man behind the project is Matt Kohler from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He spoke to the BBC's Johnny Diamond.
Sarcasm, humour or hyperbole and politeness, they involve the use of language and context to provide meanings, right? And humans are, for the most part, reasonably good at understanding those kinds of pragmatic phenomena. And we recognize this not from the words per se, but from the melody, so the way it is spoken. Critically, no devices can compute when we're being sarcastic or when we're just joking. The big challenge is data. So like all attempts to train an algorithm, you need a lot of data to do so. And sarcasm data just can't be found in high enough quantities to do conventional machine learning with it. So in this case, we trained our algorithm using a data set called Mustard++. That's comprised of recordings from American sitcoms.
Honey, are you all right?
I'll be fine. Is this about Arnie?
No, Blanche. She's upset because they keep changing the taste of Coke.
Oh, my God. You almost gave me a heart attack. Oh.
Those recordings are annotated for sarcasm by experts, and we use those annotations as training data for our algorithm. We are recognizing right now American sarcasm as a case study, but only acted American sarcasm.
It's just a privilege to watch your mind at work.
This is really early days for advanced sarcasm recognition or more advanced human-machine interaction, but we have to start somewhere. We do intend to enlarge that data set. One challenge was the amount of data. We only had 1,200 sentences that were annotated for sarcasm. It's not really that much.
Presumably, once computers can spot, identify, highlight sarcasm, they will also be able to deploy it.
Yes. Yes, that's true. And I hesitate to talk about it because people, when they hear that, they think, oh, no, like I don't want my Roomba being sarcastic to me. Smart voices like smart homes, soon robots and other devices will permeate our lives, whether we like it or not. And to build a relationship with our devices, it's important that those devices understand when we're speaking sincerely, when we're joking sarcastically or ironically. The fact is, I still need to speak to my devices in a very stilted, kind of artificial, mechanical way. And I think that having the devices able to deploy nuanced language back at us in a way that's, of course, socially appropriate and constructive can be useful.
Professor of Speech Technology, Matt Kohler, speaking without sarcasm to Johnny Diamond. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox and the producer was Richard Hamilton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.
Press freedom. The reasons why it's under increasing pressure.
How the mass use of drones has changed the way the war is being fought.
The trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.